Gentlemen, Stewart addressed his staff, we will move our station across to meet these fine fellows. I had not expected them to pound away at our rear wall like this. However, it seems that they are coming back for more of the same. They moved off in a group just as Harding rode up to report. The dervish did some damage with that last charge, sir. We suffered 55 casualties, all told. 3 officers killed, Elliot, Cartwright, and Johnson. Another 2 were wounded. Ammunition? Still in good supply, but all 4 of the Nordenfelts are out of action. Damned rubbish. I asked for Gatlings. What about the water? Running low, sir. We must reach the wells before nightfall. That is my intention. Stewart pointed at the massed dervish cavalry drawn up along the foot of the hills. It looks as though they are about to attack with everything they have. The last desperate throw of the dice. I want you to pass the order to the 3 other walls to have the quarter column standing in reserve, just in case these fellows get inside. Oh, they'll never get in, sir. Course they won't. But see to the quarter columns, nevertheless. During the battle, the dervish had hammered away at the northern wall of the square. The men in the other 3 walls had received only the very first charge. Since then, they had taken little part. They were restless and frustrated. Now, in the face of this new threat, the sergeant strode down the ranks, detailing the quarter columns. If the enemy broke 1 wall, the square must not be allowed to collapse in upon itself. The other 3 walls must stand firm, while every 4th man, the quarter columns, rushed to stop the gap and shore up the broken wall. Before they were ready, the war drums began their frenetic rhythm, and the embayers brayed and blared. The dervish cavalry rolled forward yet again. With no troops under his direct command, Penrod had time enough to squint up at the height of the sun through the slitted lids. "It's afternoon," he thought, amazed. "We've been in play for 3 hours and more." Beside him, Jakob was fretting. "If Salida does not come to me, someone else will kill him first." "That will never do, gentle Jakob." Penrod lifted his helmet, swabbed his brow with his kerchief, and settled the helmet again at a rakish angle. Then he looked ahead as the rumble of hooves and the babble of Arab voices swelled into the deafening overture of battle. They swept up to the threshold of the square. "First rank! Rolling volleys! Fire!" The sergeants began their chant, and at regular intervals the massed gunfire thundered out. The ranks of cavalry shuddered and shook as the volleys raked them, and their advance slowed under the dreadful punishment. But they came on and on, struggling over the last few yards until they struck the wall for the 2nd time. Like raging bulls, the 2 sides locked horns, swayed and pushed, thrust and hacked. The British gave a little, then heaved themselves back. The white soldiers were adept with the bayonet. These weapons were longer reaching and quicker to recover than the swinging broadswords. For the 2nd time that day, Salida's division began to crumple. The soldiers plied the bayonets at close quarters, and some went down under the heavy crusader blades, but the rest tightened their grip, and the dervish gave ground more rapidly. Then Osman Atalan rode in at the head of his fresh reserves. He came up behind Salida and threw his full weight into the balance. His Beja were an avalanche, and nothing could stand before them. "They're in!" Along the British ranks a terrible shout went up. The unthinkable had happened. A British square had broken. The dervish poured in exultantly. They drove back the khaki line, and chaos descended on the dense maul and ruck of struggling men. Isolated British soldiers dropped and died under the dervish blades and were trampled beneath the hooves. "There is but one God!" the Agajirs shouted as they killed and killed again. The troopers of the shattered north wall were swiftly broken up into tiny groups of 3 and 4 men under the weight of Osman Atalan's Agajirs. As they were pushed back, Penrod ran forward to meet them and gathered some of the strays to his own command. "Form on me, lads! Back to back, shoulder to shoulder!" he shouted. They recognized his authority and presence and fought their way to him. As they came together, they hardened into a cohesive whole, a prickly hedgehog of bayonets in the fluid fury of the fight. Other officers were rallying the scattered troopers. Harding had gathered up a dozen, and the 2 bands melded. They were no longer a pair of tiny hedgehogs, but a fierce porcupine rattling steel quills. An Arab on a tall black camel smashed into them, and before they could cut him down he had lanced Harding through the belly. Harding dropped his sword and seized the lance shaft in both hands. The Arab still had hold of the butt. With a single heave, Harding plucked him off his saddle. They fell in a tangle together. Penrod snatched up the sword Harding had dropped and rammed the point between the dervish's shoulder blades. Harding tried to rise, but the lance tip was deep in his guts. He tried to pull it out, but the barb held. He sank down again, bowed his head and closed his eyes, clutching the shaft with both hands. Penrod stood over him to protect him, and his troopers closed the gaps on either hand. It was good to have a fine sabre in his hand again. The blade had wonderful balance and temper. It came to life in Penrod's hand. Another dervish rushed at him, swinging overhand with the broadsword. Penrod caught the heavy blade high in the natural line and deflected it past his shoulder. It sliced open Penrod's sleeve, but did not break the skin beneath. Before the dervish could recover, Penrod killed him with a thrust through the throat. He had a moment to glance round. His little group was standing firm. Their bayonet blades were dulled, and their arms black with clotted Arab blood. "Forward, lads!" Penrod called to them. "Close the breach!" "Come on, boys, let's see these fellows off!" A familiar voice piped at Penrod's elbow. Percy Stapleton was beside him. He had lost his helmet, and his curly hair was dark with dust and sweat, but he was grinning like a demented ape as he cut and thrust at another dervish, then hit him cleanly in the chest. Penrod saw at once that Percy was a practised natural swordsman. When a dervish swung low at his knees, Percy jumped lightly over the blade and cut the Arab across the side of the neck, half-severing it. The man dropped his broadsword and tried to grab at his throat with both hands. Percy killed him with a quick thrust. "Well done, sir," Penrod was mildly impressed. "You are too kind, sir." Percy flicked his hair out of his eyes, and they both looked round for another opponent. But quite suddenly the dervish charge ran out of momentum. It slowed and hesitated, heaved forward again, then ran up against the mass of couched camels of the British baggage train, and stopped dead. The two opposing sides clinched and leant against each other like exhausted boxers in the tenth round, too weary to throw another punch. "Quarter columns forward!" General Stuart took command of his reserves at this crucial moment when all hung in such fine balance. They wheeled in behind him. Sword in hand, he stalked ahead on long legs like a marabou stalk. He led them round the bulwark of kneeling baggage camels, and they took the stranded dervish in their left flank. The scattered and exhausted bands of British troopers saw them coming, took new heart, and hurled themselves back into the fray. The ruptured square began to contract and repair the tear in its outer fabric. Osman Atalan, with the sure instinct of the warrior, recognised the moment when the battle was lost. He turned his mare back, then he and his agajirs fought themselves clear before the jaws of the trap could close on them. They galloped away to the safety of the hills and left Salida and his sons enmeshed in the British square. Salida was still sitting high on his camel, but the wound above his hip had burst open again, and blood was streaming down his legs. His face was yellow as the mud of a sulphur spring, and the sword had fallen from his trembling hand. Rufa'a sat up behind him, and with an arm around his waist held him upright despite the camel's terrified plunges. Salida was dazed by the lethargy of his wounds, and the shock of watching his younger sons die under the British bayonets. He looked for them in childlike bewilderment, but their broken bodies were lost under the trampling hooves. Yakob saw an opening in the dervish ranks as they turned to meet Stuart's reserves. "I have private affairs to attend to, Effendi," he called to Penrod. But Penrod and Percy Stapleton had found three more maddened dervish to deal with and did not notice as he slipped away. As Yakob ran up behind Salida's camel, he scooped up a broadsword from the hand of a dead Arab. The animal was kicking and plunging, but Yakob dodged the flying hooves, which might have delivered a killing blow. With a powerful double-handed swipe, he cut through the tendons in one of the beast's hind legs. It bellowed and lurched forward on three legs, but he ran after it and hacked through the other hamstring. The camel collapsed onto its hindquarters. Salida and Rufa'a were hurled violently from its back. Ruffat kept hold of his father and tried to break his fall as they struck the ground at Jacob's feet. Ruffat looked up and recognized him. "Jacob ben Affar," he said, and the bitter hatred of the blood feud roughened his voice. But he was holding his father with both hands and unable to defend himself. "Mine enemy," Jacob acknowledged, and killed him. He left the broadsword buried to the hilt in his chest and drew his dagger. He caught a handful of Salida's silver beard and pulled his head back, exposing his throat. He did not hack at the windpipe, but drew the razor edge of the dagger across the side of the wattled throat. It sliced through the carotid artery under Salida's ear, and Jacob made no effort to avoid the jet of bright blood that spurted over his hands and arms. "She is avenged," he whispered, as he daubed the blood on his forehead. He would not utter his sister's name, for she had been a whore, and many good men had died because of her. He let go of Salida's beard and let his face flop into the dust. He left him lying beside his son and ran back to Penrod's side. The breach in the British square closed on the dervish like the mouth of a sea anemone on a small fish that had swum into its tentacles. The dervish asked no quarter. Martyrdom was the way to eternal life, and they welcomed it. Stuart's men knew that they would not surrender. Like a poisonous serpent with a broken back, they would strike at any hand extended to them, no matter how compassionately. Relentlessly the soldiers plied the bayonet and the sword, but it was dangerous bloody work, for each dervish had to be surrounded and cut down. While there was life in them, they fought on. The slaughter went on through the afternoon, raging at first, then gradually subsiding. Even when it seemed it was over, it was not. Among the mounds of corpses, individual Ansar were feigning death, poised to leap on any unwary victim. They lost a half a dozen more men to these furtive assassins before General Stuart ordered the advance. They gathered up their own casualties, and there were many. They took with them 94 wounded and 74 British corpses, wrapped in their own blankets, as they marched away towards the palm grove at the limit of the plain that marked the wells of Abu Klea. Among the palms they threw up a zareba and buried their dead, laying them gently in rows in the shallow communal grave dug hastily in the sandy earth. It was evening before Penrod could go to find Harding in the hospital bivouac. "I have come to return your sword, sir," he proffered the beautiful weapon. "Thank you, Ballantyne," Harding whispered weakly. "It was a gift from my wife." His face was as pale as candle wax. They had moved his stretcher close to the fire because he had complained of the cold. He reached out painfully and touched the blade, as if in farewell. "However, I doubt I shall have much further use for it. Keep it for me, and use it as you did today." "I will not accept that, sir." "You will march with us into Khartoum," Penrod assured him, but Harding sagged back onto the stretcher. "I think not," he murmured. He was right. He was dead before daybreak. The rest of the men were too exhausted to move on. Although he was haunted by thoughts of the great and lonely man waiting for them in Khartoum, Stuart could not drive them on in their present state. He gave them that night and most of the next morning to recover. They rested until noon in the scanty shade of the palm grove around the wells. The water was filthy, almost as salty as seawater. They boiled it with black tea and the last of the sugar. In the enervating heat of midday, Stuart dared delay no longer. He gave the order to continue the march. They loaded the seriously wounded onto the camels, and when the bugler sounded the advance, they toiled away across the burning land. They marched on through the rest of that day, then on again through the night. They had covered 23 miles before sunrise, and then they stopped. They could go no further. They were utterly exhausted. There remained only a few cupfuls of water for each man. The camels were all played out. Even though they could smell the river ahead, they could not go on. The wounded were in desperate straits. Stuart knew he would lose most of them unless he could bring them to the water. He sent a runner to summon Penrod. "Ballantyne, I have need of your local knowledge again. How far is it to the river?
We're very close, sir. About 4 miles.
You'll be able to see it from the next ridge. 4 miles, Stuart mused. He looked back over the exhausted British formation. 4 miles might as well have been 100, for all the hope he had of getting them there. He was about to speak again, but Penrod interrupted him.
Look ahead, sir. Up on the ridge of higher ground that lay between them and the river, a small band of 50 or so dervish had appeared. All the officers reached for their telescopes. Through the lens, Penrod at once recognised the banner of Osman Atalan. Then, in the centre of the band, he picked out his tall, lean figure on the back of the cream-coloured mare.
"Not too many of them," said Sir Charles Wilson, Stuart's second-in-command, but his tone was dubious. "We should be able to brush them aside without too much trouble. I don't think they will have the temerity to come at us again, not after the lesson we gave them at the Wells." Penrod was about to contradict him. He wanted to point out that Atalan was a clever tactician. He had pulled his men out of the lost battle at Abu Klea before they were utterly destroyed. During the previous day and night, his scouts must have shadowed the battered British square, waiting for this moment when they had used up all their strength and endurance and their camels were finished. With an effort, Penrod bit back the words.
"You wanted to say something, Ballantyne?"
Stuart had not lowered his telescope, but he had been aware of Penrod's reaction.
"That is Osman Atalan himself on the cream horse. I think there are more than just that one troop. He got off comparatively lightly at Abu Klea. His divisions are almost intact."
"You're probably right," Stuart agreed.
"There is dust on the right," Penrod pointed out.
All the telescopes turned in that direction, and another group of several hundred more dervish cavalry appeared upon the ridge. Then there was more dust further to the left. Swiftly the numbers of the enemy swelled from 50 to thousands. Their sullen squadrons stood squarely across the road to the Nile. Stuart lowered his telescope and snapped it shut. He looked directly at Sir Charles Wilson.
"I propose to lager the baggage and the wounded here in a zareba, and leave 500 able-bodied men to protect them. Then, with a flying column of 800 or 900 of the fittest men, we shall make a run for the river."
"The camels are done in, sir," Wilson cut in quickly. "They'll never make it."
"I am aware of that," said Stuart crisply. Privately, he had come to think of his second-in-command as a man who could smell the dung in a bed of roses. "We will leave the camels here with the wounded and proceed on foot."
He ignored the shocked expressions of his staff and looked at Penrod.
"How long would it take you to lead us to the river, Ballantyne?"
"Without the wounded and the baggage, I can have you there in 2 hours, sir," Penrod answered, with all the confidence he did not feel.
"Very well. The company commanders will select their strongest and fittest men. We will march in 40 minutes' time at 1500 hours precisely."